Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige film. Today, we're going to be talking about 2016's Oscar-winning Monster. It's not Monster, it's Moonlight. It is directed by Barry Jenkins, who also wrote, directed, and I think produced the Dear White People, the Netflix series. Also, a new miniseries, The Underground Railroad. He got a start directing Medicine for Melancholy, a romantic film drama back in 2008. Screenplay also by Barry Jenkins, based on a story by Terrell Alvin McCraney called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, which is name-checked in the film. It stars Trevante Rhodes, who was in The Predator, which I haven't seen, but he also memorably pops up shirtless in a black cowboy hat smoking a cigar in season one of Westworld. I think he's in a wedding party. And Andre Holland, which Bald Move fans will probably recognize from the Nick from the Roanoke season of American Horror Story. He's also been in Selma, 42, and the new Netflix series Passing. Janelle Monáe, who showed up in Hidden Figures and Harriet, and also the live action Lady and the Tramp. She's also slated to be in Knives Out too. We'll look for her there. Ashton Sanders, who's been in The Equalizer and Judas and the Black Messiah, Jarrell Jerome, who's since appeared in the Netflix miniseries When They See Us, Naomi Harris, who you might remember was a sea witch in Pirates of the Caribbean. She's Moneypenny in all the modern Craig Bond films, and she's a real piece of work in this movie. And Mahershala Ali, of course, Bald Move fans will recognize him from House of Cards, True Detective Season 3. And guess what, Jim? Did you know this? Yeah, you know this because I already told you.
Yeah.
Blade. Marvel's cast him to be the new Blade. And that's like, of course.
It's a good choice.
That's just the, that's Control C, Control V casting right there. Moonlight. What did you think of Moonlight?
I'm glad. This is one of those movies that makes me glad for the Academy being there, picking some movies sometimes, because this is a movie I almost certainly would not have seen had it not been for the fact that it won Best Picture the year that it was nominated, and that it was nominated at all, right? Like, I would not have even known to seek this movie out, but I really enjoyed it. I don't have a ton to relate to in this movie. Like, I'm not gay. I'm definitely not black. I don't know how that life goes, but there is some sort of unifying trauma here, or unifying like adversity here with just being different. And I think so many people can identify with that, right? Like, yeah, being sort of not like everybody else around you. And so that was what really got me about it. And it's such a, the way they depict this is so natural. It just feels like you're watching someone's life, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I really did. There's a lot to say about this movie, and I want to echo, like, yes, this is about a young black man growing up in Miami who happens to be gay, from a very underprivileged segment of the society, and he's mixed up in drugs and all kinds of stuff. But I found a lot of the stuff it has to say about, like, the masculinity and like being bullied and different is stuff that's easy to translate. And I found, you know, this stuff that I continually find is like that poor people around the country, white or black, have a lot in common, urban and rural, because like a lot, they buy into a lot of the same kind of fucked up social structures, you know, like these instead of like, you know, going through the process of dealing with the bully and physical abuse and like, you know, illegal and not on the streets kind of way, you just bust somebody over the head. And, you know, where does that lead? I like really identify with that, because I felt like the high school I lived in, you know, like you tell a teacher that you're getting bullied. What the fuck you want? You want more bullying? And the idea that right. Like you get into, like, the cops would be involved if there was a fight. Like, there's just, it just was, is yeah, it just didn't enter our head. So like I found myself really identifying with that. And I remember at the time also, like, this movie's beautiful. And I remember at the time a lot of black folk that I follow in terms of like film criticism and filmmaking were just like really overjoyed at how well lit this movie is, because that's a common complaint that, like, you know, it's hard to it's hard to light black skin, you know, which is usually right. means I, in my career, I've never had the challenge of lighting black skin because, you yeah. know, we're just getting to the era of like all black movies and all. So this movie, the cinematographer really takes the time and some very tough, like very dark shots, like in bedrooms with that light, out on the beach with the, you know, at nighttime with that, you know, underneath streetlights and stuff. And everything is just well lit and mm-hmm. very atmospheric, like the neon, the moonlight, the streetlights, everything kind of, you know, gives like a wash over thing. So it's every very detailed, but also can give like skin an orange hue or a purple skin, or maybe even sometimes black boys look blue, it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that stuff was gorgeous. And the thing that really took my breath away is casting. Like if.
Yeah.
You could have told me that this had been like a Linkletter project uh-huh. where he had like got this kid when he was 8 years old and then shut down production every 8 years to film. And I would have believed it. And you can kind of see it from the movie theater, the movie poster where they, you know, it's a very arresting image where they've cut three slices of this man's face. And, you know, it's depicted as like the 10 or 11 year old and the 16 year old and the probably 26. I don't know how old he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it all just fits, like it looks like one face. And it's astonishing. It's like it's really crazy. Like I don't know if we should talk about that now or like in the spoiler section.
I mean,
because it's yeah, maybe one just, of the big magic tricks of this movie.
It is. And I wasn't sure they could pull it off at some point during this movie, but they definitely did. I would say maybe we should kind of introduce what the movie is about and then we can talk about maybe the structure of it, because that's one of yeah. the important things when it comes to that casting.
Yeah. This is a movie about a little boy named Chiron who grows up in a poor neighborhood in Miami. His mom gets addicted to drugs and it hasn't really got. I mean, this feels like something that could be seen in The Wire, except for it's Miami, not Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't really have anyone to look out after him until he does, but he also doesn't know, you know, not sure who he can trust, you know, like the feeling of what it must feel like to be an 11-year-old with at this end of the rope, you know, and how that little boy grows up and is formed through school and life experiences and to the man he eventually becomes. And yeah. I don't know, it doesn't sound especially interesting, but it's really interesting, and they use like title cards in a really interesting way, almost like the way 2001 uses the monolith. Like every time you see like a black title screen with like a Roman numeral and a someone's name, it's like, oh, we're about to see an intense leap forward in like personal growth or
yeah
stuff like. And I
transition,
I thought that
for sure.
Yeah, these transitions and stuff. I thought that was really interesting too.
Uh-huh.
Very yeah. artful movie.
And that's the thing that impressed me about the casting is every time they did that in this three act structure here, I looked at the kid and or I looked at the actor who was portraying that same character and I saw the kid in it. You know, I saw the path between this little kid, little and this grown man, black. And it's yeah, it's pretty astonishing how well these actors were able to pull that off.
It does. It felt like a special effect. Mm-hmm. So I guess we can get into like the spoiler section now that if you missed this, I highly recommend going back and see it. It reminded me of, you know, the Roger Ebert quote about movies being empathy engines. You know, that he says like we're all born a certain package. We are who we are. It's a sum of who we where we were born, how we were raised, and we're kind of stuck inside that person. We can't get out of it. But movies are these empathy engines that allow us to reach out and empathize with people, find out what makes them tick, what makes them care about. And I thought this movie was, you know, because like I said, as you mentioned, not gay, not black, but like I've always wondered, you know, like what does certain aspects of the gay experience look like? Like, you know, what does it feel like or what does it look like if you're two boys who might be curious? How does it and what does it feel like to flirt, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I guess like this movie makes it seem like it's a lot like flirting with boys and girls. It's sure. just like you flatter and flirt with a boy about things that boys like.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of like do like, you know, seeing like kind of being aware of like, oh, this person might be interested in me. Oh, they're really interested in me. Oh my God, they got my hands out of my pants.
Yeah.
Like it felt, you know, kind of universal when you boil it down to that.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's the thing too, with these types of movies that are made from a semi autobiographical perspective. Cause I don't often trust film, or I guess growing up in the '90s, I've been trained not to trust film that is outside of my experience. Because it's all fantasy. Yep. But then you get movies like this where you have someone who is kind of telling you what their life was like. And mm-hmm. I start to be able to trust that a lot more, you know, and I start to be able to feel like I understand the experience of a particular person or even a larger demographic through film. And mm-hmm. that's valuable. That's where it does become an empathy engine, not just entertainment.
Yeah, and like some of the, like, it seems like a lot of the gay experiences I've seen in film and TV thus far are like kind of larger than life experiences. I think about like, you know, the stuff we saw in The Deuce, where you had like these wild disco parties, and you had like, you know, the meeting at different places for anonymous sex and stuff that like, it didn't really connect with any experience that I've ever had, like in mm-hmm. the wild party and go time and high fashion, all that stuff. And this feels kind of, I guess, like Brokeback Mountain, where it just feels like, oh, yeah. This is how this experience can be in a form where I can like begin to relate to, like, mm-hmm. you know, like what is it like for me in high school and junior high to start having, you know, feelings for other people. It didn't look like a swank Studio 57 or whatever thing in New York City. It felt like, no. You know, fumbling around and being awkward and, you know, being afraid that the other person is going to judge you and not in like, even like, oh, might beat the shit out of me because they think I'm gay, but just like reject you, period. Mm-hmm. And then you have that other layer on top of it.
Right.
And I just thought that was, like you said, and it's all because I think that a lot of what's happened, especially if you're talking about the, you know, go back 10, 20 years ago, was people who probably weren't gay, mm-hmm. trying to imagine what it was like, or like new gay friends were trying to tell the story of a but like, exactly. Not really about like what it's like to just live and be.
Yeah.
And now we're getting those experiences and like slice pretty fine, like what it's like to be gay boy in a particular time in Miami. And mm-hmm. I thought that stuff was really interesting. All right. We're going to get further into the film, but first a quick break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah, well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
All right, Jim, here's my opening question.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about the Mahershala Ali character, the Juan character that's in the first act of this film?
I liked that character. I think that character is a man in conflict with himself. I think he knows he's doing some bad things, and he still wants to think of himself as a good guy. And that kind of comes to a head and is like, gets very interesting when he comes face to face with the bad things he's doing, right? As personified in Chiron. Mm-hmm. So I really liked that character. I do question how someone can win an Oscar, because he won an Oscar for this performance as best supporting actor.
Really?
With okay. like five minutes maybe of screen time.
That's like the Anthony Hopkins rule. Like, he's in Silence Lamp for 5 minutes, but what a fucking 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But I don't even know that this is the best 5 minutes. Like, yeah, it's a good performance. I've seen him give really good performances. I don't think he's like not deserving of an Oscar. I think he could certainly earn it, but this was a strange choice for me as best supporting actor. Because it's just, there's not a ton there.
I didn't know going in. I knew that this thing won the Academy Award because it famously, you know, La La Land. There's a mix up with Warren Beatty and La La Land, and you know, two crews up on stage, and it's like I remember thinking, like, you know, I saw La La Land, I hadn't seen Moonlight. But I didn't know anything else about, like, did it win for Best Director? Did it win for the And when I heard that, I wasn't surprised, because I've seen Mahershala do a lot of like really big things and like impressive things. Like, he's played multi-generations of people himself in True Detective season 3.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that performance at the dinner table, I think, is worth it because it's just real.
Yeah.
Like, seeing him like incandesce with shame at these basic questions that this little boy is answering. And he could have told lies. He could have told half truths and flattering things, and for whatever reason, because of the moment of time, and he's trying to do something genuine with this kid, he's just like brutally honest with them, and it's I don't know, man, it just felt real. And like, the like
does
to do that against sitting across the table with a real 11-year-old, I think does take some real talent and reserve, because it'd be really easy to play that like really big, you know,
for sure. Yeah. And the movie doesn't do that. The movie gives you exactly what you need in that scene. And I'm very impressed by that scene, and I'm impressed by him in that scene. I guess I was just hoping for more than like a scene to be impressed by.
It's like, imagine if Marlon Brando's Godfather performance was just the wedding scene, and then you never see him again.
Right.
Like, would he deserve an Oscar? I don't know if he actually won him, but would he deserve an Oscar? I don't know. But like, you're right. We get that kind of level of just utter reality and just like, you know, catch your breath watching the scene, and then it's just gone. I actually was shocked. I thought he would be.
I did too.
You know, like, we'd keep checking in, and Juan would be different, and this guy would be different, and like that father figure just stepping out of the film was a big surprise to me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense, right? He's a drug dealer, and they make it clear that he's dead. And dead sometime between when this kid is 11 and 17 16, or whatever he is.
17, do you think Juan is a closeted gay man? Because when I said, like, you know, what is his deal? Like, you got all the duality and all that kind of stuff, but like, part of the duality is like, where did this drug dealer in his hyper-masculine environment get all this empathy and sympathy for a kid that might be gay?
Maybe.
And that speech about black boys in the moonlight that he gave, like, you know, the only other context we see black boys in the moonlight is on the beach that he was talking about, and it looked like kind of like maybe a gay hookup site.
It could be. I was reading more as like, these were the defining moments of this kid's life. Chiron being taken to the beach by this man who had saved him, who was kind to him. It was kind of one of the big moments in his life, as was the moment on the beach with Kevin, as was those types of moments sort of defined who he is, I think. So I was reading it from that angle. I don't know. The movie, I don't think, gives you any way to know. Because it could also be that this man just saw a young kid, a small kid, being bullied by a bunch of other kids and felt empathy for him and went to help him out.
I agree. And like, you know, then you'd have to be like, well, is Janelle Monáe like some kind of like beard type relationship that he worked out to kind of like keep the heat off of? But like, I do think that something, some experience in his life has given him this empathy. I don't know whether he had like a cousin that was gay or like a friend from school that was gay that enabled him. Cause like, it just feels like if a guy is just walking around, it'd be like your average, like, you know, mid 20s guy walking around our hometown back in the 90s. Like if you stopped him and asked him what he thinks about gay people, it probably wouldn't have been a very enlightened answer, you know, because it's just a default thing. You know, I've never met one, never seen any, kind of looks like crazy in TV and film. But like, so what broke him out of that shell? I don't know what it is, but like, I just thought that scene at the dinner table where him and his, like, you know, he's trying to like piece his way through this conversation. And then like, he's looking at his girlfriend for kind of like, you know, guidance and like, you know, where to like maybe pull back a bit. There's so much that's kind of left to the imagination or to the inference in this film. I just kind of was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah. I don't know, because I also see him sort of being a lot like Kevin as well, who I would maybe call Kevin bi. I'm not sure, you know, what exactly Kevin would identify as, but I see him like maybe when he was younger, sort of being pressured into the life he's in now, right? Because that's what happens to Kevin. He gets pressured into beating the shit out of Chiron by these other kids who are clearly, they're not interested in being his friend. They just want to make him do some stupid shit because they can't.
Right.
They're assholes. Right. They're bullies. Yeah. And I could see maybe Juan getting in sort of that way. And just, you know, understanding like that was bullying and they bullied me into the life I'm in. And if this kid keeps getting bullied this way, he's going to turn out bad.
Yeah. And maybe also like knowing that like he got his mom addicted to drugs and, you know, someone's got to look out for this guy. Like he's trying to, you know, clean up he's like the Exxon Valdez and he spilled some oil and he's trying to clean it up as best as he can, maybe.
Yeah, later on, certainly it's part that too. Yeah.
But I thought that was like really fascinating. Him. Just everything, meeting the guy's, Chiron's mom, of course, he'd already known her before and kind of like, you know, how that all went. There's just a lot of like, and I've only seen this movie one time, but I feel like you watch those first 20, 25 minutes a couple of times and you would get a lot more because there's a lot of things going back and forth between the mom and him and the mom and him and that guy and the mom's boyfriend and him and Chiron and that's just very, very subtle. Very subtle acting. And there's also like, you know, like I thought they did a good job of showing like experiences you get, like, you know, because Chiron's the age, he's like 11, 12, like the age where you start noticing. We usually say noticing the opposite of sex, but you start noticing sex and you start like your body starts like waking up to that stuff. And like they're playing a game, you know, schmear the schmear, I guess, is what it looks like is what
forget the name,
polite way to say it,
like get down, get up or something, I think was the game.
Oh, is that what that was? Because I thought it was just playing, you know, the like you grab the ball and it's essentially a game that like I said, has a very rude name, but like it's essentially football without rules. It's like whoever's got the ball, you tackle them. It's fun and it's violent, but also you're rubbing a lot of boy bodies together.
boys,
when I switched to bodies, but yeah, boy bodies, you're rubbing a lot of boy bodies together. I'm not gonna mince words. That's what the that's what the game's all about. And you give it the homophobic slur name so you feel good about rolling around with the boys, rubbing your bodies against each other, I guess. But you know, you saw like you get to like the second one, you know, where he goes from little to Chiron and you see he's in high school, but and you're thinking, oh, maybe he's gotten a little, you know, a little leg up in his social situation, but he hasn't got the exact same problems. He's still running from bullies. His mom's gotten even worse, where she's like, you know, not even trying to hide her addiction and taking like shameless advantage of the kid.
Yeah, I fell for him in these scenes in particular because, man, it's messy. Like you said, figuring out your sexuality and how to navigate that. I remember it. It's been almost 20 years for me, but like, yeah, that's a messy time in your life. And I didn't even have the extra complication of being gay or not even just being gay, but like being ostracized for your sexuality, right? Mine
that's the thing.
Was in line yeah. with the quote unquote norm. So like, yeah,
like, imagine having to like come out as straight, you know, like if right. people were waiting for you to like declare something, your parents are nervous about it. Like, you know, it's like that's something that like when you're in the society default, you don't have to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But like also that, you know, the masculinity, because, you know, this kid, there's such a contrast. This is one of those movies that has a huge contrast between very beautiful things and very awful things. Like those boys forcing Kevin to beat the shit out of Chiron and then them all jumping him and just, you know, fucked him up. And the teacher, I thought that was another really cool detail, of like how you can disassociate. Like there's this social worker, guidance counselor, principal trying to reach him. Mm-hmm. And as she's like, you know, he hears all the things that she says are kind of vaguely accusatory, trying to like, you know, wake him up. But as she tries to start actually helping him, that her voice gets quieter and quieter and quieter till he can't even hear her anymore.
Yeah.
And all he can hear is like, I thought that was a really interesting detail. Like that, like he's just tuning out all the things that she was saying that could possibly help, because she's trying to get him to press charges. She's like, I can't, mm-hmm. you know, I got a mom here. If you're not willing to press charges, and he's like, you know, trying to see like how the masculine code of conduct works, doesn't do it. But it's interesting that he comes back and retaliates against this kid, beats him down, and that kid, the hyper-masculine one that's enforcing the sexuality, apparently either doesn't mind snitching or has parents that like, what the fuck, we're pressing charge. Because this kid, this Chiron, goes to juvie.
Yeah, yeah, and I think when he gets out, they move to Atlanta, is that right?
He gets shipped to Atlanta as part of the prison system.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
I thought that was so interesting. That kid, like, you know, it felt like Lex Luthor at the Legion of Doom, you know, acting all hard, and then Superman knocks on the door and he's like, call the cops, you know, because like, yeah, and that's like, you know, this whole masculine paradigm was bullshit.
Yeah, no, I hate it. I hate seeing people like that. This bully is just the worst. He's the worst.
Did you
bring people into, it's not even that he's bullying himself. I mean, he is, but then he's got to bring other people in to do his dirty work for him. And fuck
the
that.
Manipulation
yeah.
of Kevin was
like, hey,
really
I'm your
gross.
Friend. You're cool. We're cool. And then you can see it. You can see it from the jump, right? Like he sits down at the lunch table with this kid and is like acting all buddy buddy with him. And then when he walks away, he's like, he grabs his juice and says, you shouldn't drink that. It'll fuck you up or whatever.
Yeah,
he's just fucking stealing from him right there. He's just like acting like his friend. And then he's backhanded taking shit from him. Like, man, fuck that.
And there's
guy.
A couple of context things. Because I kind of got the idea, and this might be the whole like, you know, is Juan perhaps gay or has some experiences being gay? I also got the idea that he knew Kevin had some gay inclinations, too.
Maybe
a result of this jump game. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of intimating that, and like, so now Kevin, like, his masculinity is being threatened and he has mm-hmm. to, you know, beat up Chiron, or he's going to be labeled the F slur just like he is. And, you know, that makes it like, I guess we should go to the next next sequence, the third part, Black.
Okay,
where, because, like, when you see the little kid Chiron, the teenage kid Chiron, it's like, well, that's the same kid.
Uh-huh.
That's the same skinny kid with the big eyes and the sad face, and
mm-hmm.
they got the same
He's
facial
quiet
structure.
And reserved, yeah.
We go to grown Chiron, and he looks like 50 fucking cent.
Yeah.
Like, this guy is built. He's, like, thick as hell. He looks strong. He looks tough.
Uh-huh.
He is not, like, you know, like, the little Chiron's talked, you know, worried about being soft. This guy is not going to be ever accused of soft.
Mm-hmm.
But I also thought, like, I don't see it. This is not Chiron. And the most impressive thing this film does is when Kevin calls him and gives him a sincere apology for, I mean, it's brief and it's like, you know, doesn't say that, but it's like essentially just unequivocal, man, that was fucked up and I'm sorry I did that to you.
It's that stereotypically masculine apology, right?
Yeah, but it's more than most people, it's more than a lot, sure. a lot of people get, and it instantly brings that 50 Cent guy back to that 11-year-old with the face, like his face withdraws and shrinks. It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane what they do.
Yeah, that's a crazy good performance. I think if anybody deserved an Oscar for this, it might be that dude.
I'm kind of surprised he didn't for lead. Like, okay, give Mahershala the supporting, but like, I mean, just for, if you're going to give Mahershala an Oscar for that dinner scene, then you got to give it for this guy for the instant transformation from tough as nails dude to 11-year-old kid.
I would think so. His name's Trevante Rhodes. I need to look up if he was actually nominated, because he might have been nominated. Actually, no, he wasn't nominated. All right, well, that sucks for him, because I thought he was amazing. The transformation, and I really like the way that they let you in on how that transformation existed, right? Like, it goes all the way back to when he was little. Kevin came up to him and said, "You can't be soft." Like, and then they rolled around and wrestled, and he was like, "Yeah, I knew you weren't soft." And so when he had an opportunity to get away from everything else, get away from the people who knew him as little, who knew him as this quiet, you know, shy gay kid, he rebuilt himself entirely. And he tells Kevin that, like, I, you know, when I went to Atlanta, I started from the ground up and I just rebuilt a person. And you can tell he built a person that was influenced by everything he thought he should have been.
Yeah.
And
all
it's
the
not
lessons.
Him. But
yeah,
he took all those lessons of toxic masculinity and just poured them into a mold, and out comes Black. It's fucked up, but you totally understand how he gets there. And I think that actor just nails it, both sides of it, right? When that surface cracks and you see through it and you see little, you see Chiron in there. Yeah, he's incredible.
And I think that they're like, I talked about these title sequences being kind of like the monoliths in 2001. Like, it's astonishing. You see this kid wake up and he's this new rebuilt individual. And there's this great oneer where he goes in his car and picks up his buddy and he gets in the side door. And I don't know how they filmed it. It seems like the door would get in the way of the camera's POV. But I thought that was pretty impressive. And, you know, he's listening. And then you hit the title card and the first thing that happens is Kevin calls.
Yeah.
Hey, I haven't talked to you for a long time. Yeah. It's like, man, it's really, you know, that stuff about that happened way back the last time we saw, it's like, I think about that all the time and it's really messed up and I'm sorry that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then he starts thinking, his mom calls, you know, like, he's been up Atlanta for a while. You all come see your mom. And those are two like pulls back home.
Yeah.
And his mom hits him up with another unequivocal apology, like, great, she's got scene. Her life together. Another great scene where it's like, I've seen this written by someone who's never lived it, I think. Where it's like, the, you know, or maybe a person that hasn't like actually done the work, but like, you usually see this and the mom just like, you know, it's like, well, you know, stuff was fucked up, but I'm your mother and I love you and all that. And but like, I really like the grace that she gives him, where she's like, you probably can't hear me say this and you might not believe it and you might not trust me. And I didn't have the love for you that I have now when you needed it. But like, you know, just unequivocally not make excuses. Just like, I fucked up as a parent and I love you and I wish I'd done better and I can't go back and fix it now, but we could. That, like, both of those things, those twin things of these two people from his past that have deeply wounded him and made him do all these maladaptive things. You know, this guy's like super hard. He's, but also very walled off. Like, something consistently through this movie is Chiron is just lonely.
Yeah.
Doesn't open to anybody. And he finally meets Kevin at dinner. And that's just a long sequence. Like, you know, like, there's like, they spend a lot of time together just kind of talking around the issue. And when Chiron finally says, like, you're the first person that's ever touched me and you're the first person I've ever touched. I think it's the first like confession that he's made, or like some kind of like vulnerability he's shown in the whole movie. Mm-hmm. And the movie builds up that movie beautifully, and that's kind of the end of the movie. You know, like that breakthrough, that little bit of evolution in his character. It's beautiful.
That was an interesting line to me, because I thought that Juan had almost got there with Chiron. It was like, if Juan had not been selling drugs to his mom, I think he would have been like that sort of father figure. Although I think Chiron does still take a little bit away from his experience with Juan, right? I think that is a defining moment in his life, with the water and learning to swim, and mm-hmm. And the way that Juan describes it, about, you know, living in Cuba and this being the water being sort of a branching point, or like the duality of the water, right? Like being you know, one thing but also another. I think that does affect him, but he can't quite get there. He can't, you know, Juan doesn't touch him because he's just like he's doing this terrible thing in his life. And eventually Chiron realizes that and abandons him. Right. He just, that scene at the dinner table or the lunch table, breakfast table, whatever it is, he just gets up and walks away when he's like, you know, you sell drugs, right? And you're selling drugs to my mom. And he gets up and he walks away, and it's like a powerful moment. But yeah, I do think Juan was close to that for him, but didn't quite get there because of, you know, his age at the time and the things he was doing.
And I think the movie gives you a little bit of like, maybe Juan, I mean, obviously Juan kept up those bridge building exercises and did a lot of good for Chiron. And then when he died, that left it, you know, suddenly he was like, back to, like, you can see him trying to use Juan's ex, or I guess widow, or
Teresa,
whatever, Teresa, as that try to find stability. And you can tell, like, you know, she's got, it's all love and pride in this house, blah, and that's like what he needs. But then the bullies get a hold of him and like realize that he's using that. It's like, it's just like fucking sharks with blood in the water, like realizes that's a crutch he's using, or that's something that's positive, and they take it from him, you know. But yeah. And I wonder, like, I wonder what would have happened if he, like, if Juan had been, like, just a middle-class guy, like, you know, just a guy who ran a bodega in the neighborhood, or someone who, like, you know, worked at the factory or had a union job and didn't have to be like, I sold your mom drugs. I'm the one who turned your mom into a monster. Like, what would have that, like, you know, like Bunny Colvin from The Wire, if that had been who Juan was. But is still somebody he needed. And when you see man version of Chiron, he's just like such a carbon copy of Juan, you know, like that. I think that shows you like what the huge influence he had on him. Things with water. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say one other thing about the transformation of that character from Black to Chiron, is the grills, the fronts, I don't know what they're called, that you put on your teeth, these gold platings on his teeth, and how he pulls those out to eat his dinner, which I assume you just have to do, but also there's a transformation that happens there, right? Like, he shows up as Black, and then when he takes those out, like, that's almost removing the shield, the barrier between him and who he actually is.
I mean, I think they are called fronts, but that's like, it's an interesting,
The parallel is
because it's like it's a front. It's literally a front that he's putting on, that he takes off to show some vulnerability.
Yeah, I like that.
There's a lot of stuff about water. You know, Miami's famous for its beaches, and you know, everywhere you go, you kind of, you know, you can smell the sea breeze and probably hear the ocean. And the swimming thing was a big was a big metaphor, a transformational kind of metaphor. And then there's that great line that he has with Kevin when he's on the beach, and I forget how they got talking about, like, whether they've ever cried before. And Chiron says that sometimes he cries so much he thinks he's just going to turn to water and roll out to sea. And then adult Chiron will only drinks water. Probably, you know, history of addiction in your family, probably a good call, Chiron.
And when he's Little during the Little section of this movie. He's also filling a bathtub with buckets of water that he's heated up on the stove
because they don't have hot water. Yeah. I'm not sure how it all, I mean, water, obviously that's like, you know, like a very deeply architectural kind of thing in human history, like for something that's changeable, malleable, clearly they're playing. I gotta say, I don't understand fully the metaphor there, but like, you can definitely tell that that's what they're hinting at. Some kind of metamorphosis, change, transition from one thing to another, liquid, solid, sure, gas, that kind of stuff. There's three phases of matter that water can go through, and there's three phases that this young man goes through. I think that's all up there, but like, again, it all works as a metaphor that, like, you know, usually movies that are trying to engage a metaphor at that level are a lot more showy about it, or a lot more pointed. And this is just kind of like, it's just a kind of theme that underlines everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what else to say about the film. I've already praised the lighting, because like, that's the thing that I think this film is beautifully lit, especially with some of the nighttime scenes, this film is living proof that, like, it might be a different kind of challenge to light black skin versus white skin, but Lord, it can be done.
Yeah.
And it can be done well, where it doesn't, and it didn't look like they're like, I was wondering, like, when they sat down at the beach scene, it's like, is this going to feel like they just have a spotlight on these guys sitting in the dark? But it didn't. It felt like a night scene.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you could see everybody. You could see everyone's expression, the lines in their face. And it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the cinematographer got nominated for an Oscar. He didn't win. Actually, La La Land, you know, aside from not winning Best Picture, it did win a lot of awards that year. And that was one of them.
I'm not a big, I saw La La Land. I'm not a big fan of La La Land. And now that I've seen both of these films, like, it seems a shame that La La Land stole any Oscars from this film, because I just think this is heads and shoulders. Like, La La Land had a little bit of fun, but even in terms of musicals, it's like pretty a dour. In terms of musicals, anyway, I thought it was a pretty dour affair, and it was just kind of undermined by the fact that the two leads, not great singers and dancers. But I know I've heard all those. That's the point and all that. I feel like Moonlight is the better film, and I can't believe it's taken me 5 years to see it.
What about
anything else?
What about best original score? Because La La Land beat Moonlight in that regard too.
Okay, I'll give it that.
Okay,
it's a musical.
All right.
Like, if you can't get best original score as a musical, then like, just fucking hang it up, right?
Yeah.
You know.
For sure. This was a pretty successful movie, though. I don't know how many people went to actually see it, but it was made on like a $4 million budget at the top end of the estimates on that. And it made like $65 million. So, successful.
I mean, that's what happens when you get Mahershala Ali for 5 minutes, and then the rest of the film is mostly, and you get Naomi Harris for about 5 or 10 minutes, and the rest of the movie is relatively unknowns. They're doing just like amazing work. I thought this movie was a really not fun watch. It was just a really rewarding watch, and it was an easy watch. I don't think it's over 2 hours. I didn't actually look at the running time.
I don't think so either.
But it didn't feel like one of those mammoth 3 hour things that kind of wear you out. It just was really snappy, and the chapters of the guy's life went smoothly one for another. And again, like, if for no other reason, this film is worth watching just to see how well these three young men work together to play this one character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's, and you won't believe it in the third act. Like, you won't think this is going to be seamless. But it really is.
Yeah.
It really is what a great job he's doing aping the 11 and 17 year old version of himself. It's a great movie. It's justifiably lauded. I'm glad we finally got the chance to see it.
It keeps up like, I would say, a 50-50 hit and miss rate on A24 movies for me. Like, they're spotty, but
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like this one.
Next week, we're actually, I don't know what we're doing next week. We're starting something a little different, where periodically we're going to let We got a polling feature on Patreon. We're going to let certain segments of our patron supporters select from a list of movies that we provide. Me and Jim are like, these three movies seem like fun and we would be interested in talking about them. And, you know, which one do you guys want us to focus on? And then the losers we'll put back into some kind of list. We got this massive, like thousands of rows long spreadsheet of movies that we kind of went through and curated as stuff that we'd be interested in. And they're stuff that we're just personally interested in, have a good fond memories of, or things that were winning Oscars that year, or things that made the most money. So like, we got a big old list and we like to randomly pull names out of that. And now we're going to bring in some patrons into that selection process. So if you are a patron, check out your email address. That's where you, if you're signed up for it, you get email notifications when these things get posted. Or go to patreon.com/baldmove and check out the latest member post. You should be able to find it in there. And if you're at the appropriate tier, have your vote counted. So pretty excited about that. Thank you for listening to the podcast. We'll be back with another prestige film selected by our patrons in the weeks ahead. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And see ya.